It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Mars has been receiving a lot of attention lately, both on the silver screen and in our news. And this hour, we want to ask the question, do we have what it takes to put humans on Mars? In the new Ridley Scott movie, The Martian, a NASA botanist played by Matt Damon is stranded on Mars and must rely on his own ingenuity to survive. Well, in actual real-life news, we've heard that scientists have discovered evidence of present-day water on the Red Planet. My guest this hour, to help us contemplate a manned mission to Mars and find out the significance of this latest discovery, two astrophysicists, Steve Kowaler and Jasper Halicus, and also retired NASA astronaut Clayton Anderson. Welcome to all three of you.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Let's start off with the real-life discovery that we've had recently about Mars, namely that there is water on Mars. We had long thought that to be the case. But Steve Kowaler, tell us about this latest discovery, specifically what was found out and why is it significant?
Well, the joke going around is that NASA discovered water on Mars again. And in fact, we know that there's been water on Mars in ice, in the form of ice, both below the surface and at the poles. The thing that makes this discovery of water so much more fun is that there's now strong evidence that water in liquid form exists, at least temporarily, on the surface of Mars. And the way this was deduced was images taken from orbit showed what appeared to be flowing material flowing down a steep slope, assisted by water. And then spectroscopic observations, looking at the reflectance of light off of those flows, showed evidence for salts, hydrated salts, which means very briny water that could be liquid even at the very low temperatures at the surface of Mars.
Mm-hmm. And the significance of actually finding that water?
Again, liquid water is the elixir of life in some sense. We don't can't imagine a way that life could develop on a world without liquid water in some sort of form. And if liquid water exists now on the cold, old Mars, perhaps it was a lot more abundant in the past. And so finding liquid water on the surface, even temporarily now, suggests that there's stores of liquid water below the surface, perhaps year-round, and that enhances the possibility that life remains on Mars.
That life, there is life on Mars that we have not yet discovered beneath the surface?
Well, present but not detected is sort of an in-joke among scientists, right? Mm-hmm. It hasn't been found yet, but the conditions seem to be looking more and more appropriate.
Jasper Halicus, your research as on the faculty in the Physics and Astronomy Department at the University of Iowa focuses on space and planetary physics. You work with NASA on what is called the MAVEN mission, part of NASA's Mars Scout program. It was launched in 2013. Tell us, what are you doing in that mission? What is your role? What is the purpose of MAVEN?
Yeah, so MAVEN stands for Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution. It's very descriptive. What we're trying to do is find out where all of the atmosphere that we think Mars once had went. As Steve said, we have lots of evidence that there used to be more water on Mars. There's abundant geologic evidence in the forms of these beautiful pictures that we get of gullies and lake beds and so forth. Most of that's gone now. We've recently found maybe there's a little bit left there. But the question is where all that water went. And there's sort of two possibilities. One is that it went down into the rocks, and one is that it went out into space. On MAVEN, we're trying to measure that second possibility and understand how much of the ancient atmosphere of Mars could have been lost to space.
If you just joined us, my guests are two astrophysicists, one from the University of Iowa, one from Iowa State University, Steve Kowaler, professor of physics and astronomy at ISU, Jasper Halicus, professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Iowa. We also have Clayton Anderson with us. He's a retired NASA astronaut, now also on the faculty of Iowa State University. He spent 5 months aboard the International Space Station and is the author of a book, The Ordinary Spaceman, From Boyhood Dreams to Astronaut. Now, you have done some incredible things in space, Clayton Anderson, nearly 40 hours spacewalking in a suit, as we saw in the latest movie, The Martian. You've completed 5 months aboard the space station in 2007. I wonder if we can start with you to get reaction to The Martian as a movie. You actually went to see a special viewing of the film, special invitees.
Right. We were in Houston, and NASA actually participated with Ridley Scott to provide technical support in the development and the making of the movie, which is hugely important for those of us who have actually done it. And as part of that, Fox was gracious enough to allow many NASA engineers, scientists, astronauts, administrative folk into the theater to see a couple private screenings. So that's when I saw The Martian for the first time.
Talk about a tough audience to please. All kinds of astrophysics expertise there in that audience. So, let me ask you, Clay, what did you think of the film overall? What stood out for you?
Well, I was asked to write a review by Quartz.com, which you can find on my Twitter feed, my Facebook feed, under Astro_Clay or Astro Clay. And I would say it's a very entertaining film. Of course, there are technical issues that folks at the Johnson Space Center might giggle and snicker a little bit at.
For instance?
Well, I don't want to do a spoiler alert, but
okay.
Suffice it to say that spacewalks should require a tether. But, you know, for the most part, it was very well done. And my take from the movie was that for a person who spent his 30-year career working within NASA and the Johnson Space Center in roles that included both an aerospace engineer and then ultimately an astronaut, I was very pleased with the way they portrayed NASA's can-do attitude and we will do whatever it takes to save this mission. In addition, a nice treat was the work between the Jet Propulsion Lab, which is noted for its unmanned programs, and the Johnson Space Center and the Kennedy Space Center noted for their manned programs as they paired up and worked together to save the day. And then a third aspect was the use of a foreign entity to help them complete the mission that I think bodes well for the future. So without giving away too much, I think it was a well-done film. I was entertained. Yes, I snickered a few times. Neil deGrasse Tyson will snicker multiple times and probably write 1,000 tweets, much like he did with the movie Gravity. But if I were to recommend a movie to see, I would recommend this one. And I absolutely love Matt Damon and his irreverent attitude because he's very much like the ordinary spaceman.
Really? That attitude is found in astronauts, test pilots?
No.
No, it's not.
Oh, no. It was found in yours truly, and much to the chagrin of many in the control center. So typically, astronauts do not behave as a Matt Damon behaved in that movie.
But Clayton Anderson did up there when you spent 160-some days in space and had these space flights?
Yes, and I paid for it with...
For instance, what would be irreverent when you think back? Do you want to share an experience?
When you live in a can in outer space, whether it be soaring about the Earth or on the red planet's surface, and the ground asks you to do something that is silly or... from your perspective, unnecessary, the tendency can be for someone who's been stranded there like Mark Watney for a long time to give a smart aleck comment back. And I was prone to that, and it was frowned upon. So astronauts are sometimes expected to play a game where they are to communicate appropriately and smile a lot as they deal with the ground control team. It's a frustrating thing. It was a very frustrating thing for me in space. And I think some of that was portrayed by Watney in the movie. And many have come to me and said that Watney reminds them of me, so as an astronaut. So I'll just let it go at that.
Clayton Anderson with his former NASA astronaut, along with Steve Kowaler of Iowa State University and Jasper Halikas. We're talking about the fictional and non-fictional visions of going to Mars. Steve Kowaler, you work as an astrophysicist exploring the interior structure and evolution of stars. How did this film speak to you?
Well, I really enjoy it. I happen to have seen it with a botanist.
Really?
Yes, a friend of mine.
Uh-huh.
And he was very happy with the botany part of it. I was pretty happy with the Newtonian dynamics of it in the sense that gravity on Mars is about 40% of what it is on Earth. And when, for example, Mark Watney would drop something, it wouldn't fall as fast. as it does in on the Earth. So they got sort of the small details correct. I was a little perturbed in that I didn't recognize any of the starry backgrounds, so I think they may have faked the sky.
Oh, but it was not true to what they would actually see on Mars?
Well, what they would see on Mars is more or less what you would see on Earth in terms of the distant stars, and I didn't recognize any of the constellations or configurations. Now, that may be just me having had a beer before the movie, but it's possible they just didn't pay attention to that level of detail.
Mm-hmm. Were there parts of the movie, Steve, that made your heart swell with pride, if I can put it that way?
Well, as Clay was saying, NASA has this can-do attitude, and I couldn't help but, in the process of watching this movie and watching the efforts to get Mark Watney home, couldn't help but to think back to Apollo 13. There's clearly a lot of parallels there, though that was on a much compressed timescale. That was actually real. And I was a young lad at the time and remember the Apollo 13 saga, and that kept on crossing my mind.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you the same question, Clay, as someone who's spent many, many days in space, in the space station, circling the Earth. Did you feel pride here at any moments, watching what was happening on screen?
I think certainly as I'd mentioned, this ability of family members, fathers, mothers, uncles, aunts that work within the space program to throw aside everything that's dear to them to concentrate on their work and focus on saving the life of Mark Watney or the Apollo 13 crew is indeed a prideful, it should be prideful for all Americans. And I think that's the premise of the film that touches most of the people's hearts, is that if there is a disaster of any type, most humans on this planet rally to support and help and save those people who have been hit with this disaster. I think that's human nature. Mm-hmm. And that's a part that I'm very proud of and that I'm very proud to be a part of. And we need more of that. We need more of that throughout the Earth and throughout our solar system. But that's what struck me in the movie. And in real life, you know, the unmanned programs often fight with the human programs for funding, for priority, for experiments, for notoriety. And in the movie, it was not portrayed that way. And that's another thing I think we could do better is, as a NASA entity, is not be siloed institutions, be united institutions. And I think for a large part we are, but in certain aspects there are some unmanned or some robotic folks who argue with the human aspect of spaceflight. And it comes down mostly to money and resources.
Mm-hmm. There's one line that really stood out for me, an exchange of two lines, and I wondered what you thought about this, Clay. The director of NASA in the film says, "It's not about one man." And the Sean Bean character, if I'm correctly quoting him, says, "Yes, it is." How did you interpret that moment, if you remember it?
Well, I do remember that moment, and there's always management. I guess it would be much akin to when the United States is in a military conflict. The folks in the trenches, they do believe it is about one human, one life, whereas the field generals and the administrators who have placed us in harm's way, they think at a bigger level, at a bigger picture. And sometimes one person's sacrifice is, I hate the term, but I'll have to use collateral damage maybe, but I do believe that at NASA, when you get right down to it, it would be about that life. It would be about bringing them back safely.
Clayton Anderson with us, former NASA astronaut, as we contemplate Mars and then possible manned mission to Mars in the future. Jasper Halicus, you focus on space and planetary physics, things moving around in our solar system, how to move things from here to there. You're involved in NASA's MAVEN mission to study Mars' atmosphere. I wonder if you could describe what a manned mission to Mars would look like. How long would it take? What would be the path to prepare for it? How How many people would go? What would the spacecraft look like, possibly?
Well, first of all, Ben, I want to thank you for the opportunity to see this movie in a theater. I have two small children at home, and I haven't been to a movie in a theater in about 4 years. So if you could have me on a show like once a week to talk about movies,
well,
I'd really appreciate that.
Jasper, they will grow up. I've been there where you are. They will grow up, but you're very welcome.
So I actually thought that the movie was really well done and really accurate in the engineering details in a lot of respects, and particularly in things like Newtonian dynamics, as Steve pointed out. The orbital trajectory stuff that they had in the movie I thought was spot on, given my knowledge. I mean, they talked about things like the Hohmann transfer orbit, which is the same orbit that we use to get from Earth to Mars. It's basically a minimum energy kind of orbit where you don't aim for where Mars is now. You will aim for where Mars is going to be in 9 months, and you sort of spiral your way out there. So given the fact that Mars and Earth are both moving around the sun at different rates, there are parts of the year where they are close together and there are parts where they are quite far apart. So that in large part guides when you want to launch and where you want to aim if you want to go from Earth to Mars.
In the Martian, the movie, they travel in this large spacecraft, which is named Hermes in the movie. And since the trip to Mars takes a while, it takes, what, many months on, I mean, there are different trajectories, but it would take how many months approximately?
A standard Hohmann transfer orbit would take about 9 months to get there, 9 to 10 months.
9 months, one way. So we see in the movie humans aboard need a way to stay in shape, and there is a section of this spacecraft, which is sort of a long spacecraft, but in the middle it has 90-degree angle to it, a sort of a Ferris wheel thing, a wheel that spins to make a sort of artificial gravity. Is that doable? Is that all line up with physics?
That's all great physics, and it's all something that's been talked about a lot in conceiving of these kind of space missions. I think it's probably a more advanced spacecraft than we would have on our fourth mission to Mars. I think this was supposed to be third or fourth mission. I mean, that was quite a large spacecraft for that size of a crew compared to the spacecraft that we've launched previously and, you know, the International Space Station and things like that. I'd be impressed if we could put something that big and, you know, so that was kind of a luxury liner for a spaceship.
It was. They were sitting on board. You thought maybe the bridge of the Enterprise there. In a brief, they had their own briefing room and then their own training facility. Steve Kowaler, your reaction to the spacecraft they had in the film?
Well, we've got 30 years to come up with something like that. So who knows what could happen?
Clay Anderson, as someone, the only one at this table who's been in space, does that seem like everything aboard would be, well, a little bit too luxurious for what we could make happen in 30 years?
Houston, we have a problem.
I would love to fly on a spaceship like that. I don't know the physics well enough to know if their representation is physically accurate. I understand the principles, right? Everybody wants to know if you just rotate a spacecraft, we can have microgravity, or we can have gravity, right, so that everybody walks around normally. What's key to me here is that as we at NASA begin our journey to Mars with a thing called Orion and a rocket called the Space Launch System, people have to understand that Orion is simply a capsule that carries 4 or 5 or 6, maybe, I don't remember the number, people to low Earth orbit, where it's going to have to rendezvous and dock with something like the spaceship that's projected in the movie The Martian, which, as Steve points out, we don't have. We have 30 years to figure out if we can have one, but do you imagine the cost that's associated with building something that marvelous?
Mm-hmm.
And therein lies the difficulty. Going to Mars, we think we understand how to do that. We know the transit time. We have many ideas out there on how we can send things in advance of the humans, et cetera. We can position their launch vehicle just like they do in the movie, the inflatable habitats technology and all that sort of thing. But the issue is, how do we actually do it, and where do we get the funding to do it? And so when I watch a movie like this, I was enamored. I as I wrote in my review, I said it made me think people were already there on Mars. It was so nicely done. And I hope that we can do that someday, but it is, again, Hollywood. So what we can do as humans within the budget parameters we have will be very interesting. I hope I'm able to live long enough to see all this progress and transpire.
Does anybody have a figure, a ballpark figure of what it might cost, a manned mission to Mars?
I've seen numbers in the hundreds of billions.
Steve Qualler, hundreds of billions.
Yeah, so much less than an Iraq war, for example.
Uh-huh. Jasper?
I would have said around $100 billion, too. I mean, an unmanned mission to Mars now costs on the order of $1 billion. So I would think a manned mission is something like 100 times more expensive than that.
To send a robot to Mars is how much?
On the order of $1 billion.
Oh, $1 billion. And there are how many robots have we sent to Mars total now? Jasper?
Well, we've got 6 or 8 active missions there right now. We've got several rovers still active on the surface. We've got 3 or 4 orbiters that are active around the planet. Going back over the history of Mars, between us and other countries, there have been many more than that. So we've sent robots there. We've done that part. Getting humans there is going to be harder, but I don't think it's something that NASA can't do. NASA is a problem-solving agency, and they're very good at it. If they were given appropriate funds and consistent direction, I have to think that they could do it. It wouldn't be overnight, but, in the long run, I think it's something they could do.
Also interesting in this movie that the old and the new, the fiction and the nonfiction is mixed a bit. And not to spoil anything again here, but we do find the character does find an old probe. On the planet as well, which we would undoubtedly find if we ever landed humans on Mars and colonized Mars. I want to come back in just a moment. We're going to take a short break. Our discussion with Jasper Halicus, Associate Professor of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Iowa, Steve Qualler, astrophysicist on the faculty of Iowa State University, and Clayton Anderson is a retired NASA astronaut. He spent 5 months approximately aboard the International Space Station, so he's our man to tell us what it's really like in space and the challenges that would be faced by humans traveling this long. When we come back, we want to talk more about Mars and find out where the Mars mission is right now, what plans have been made, and also, what it would be like to colonize Mars. Is it possible? Especially considering that we know now there is some water on Mars. How much? We don't exactly know. But we'll come back with our astrophysicists and our astronaut in just a moment. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. River to River, that speaks of water. Well, we're talking about water, actual water being discovered on Mars recently. Also, on the silver screen, attention given to Mars with the Ridley Scott movie The Martian. A NASA botanist, played by Matt Damon, stranded on Mars, and he's relying on his own ingenuity to survive. And real-life news, that discovery of present-day water on the red planet. Joining us this hour to discuss a possible manned mission to Mars, the physics of it, the human side of it, the challenges for man and machine, Clayton Anderson, retired NASA astronaut. He spent 5 months aboard the International Space Station, now on the faculty of Iowa State University. Also on that faculty, Steve Qualler, professor of physics and astronomy at ISU, and Jasper Halicus, associate professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Iowa. In the break there, you mentioned something. I want to have you bring this out, Steve Qualler, that we were talking about a round ballpark figure of $1 billion to get an unmanned craft to Mars. You said it can happen even less than that.
Well, you use the term ballpark, which is kind of appropriate. For $70 million, you can upgrade your athletic facility, or you could build a spacecraft and put it into orbit around Mars, which is what the Indian government did 2 years ago. That spacecraft has been orbiting now for 2 years. They just produced a lovely atlas of images of Mars to celebrate that. So there are ways of doing it at a very low cost. They're sort of bargain basement probes, if that.
So I wonder, Steve, Are you the right person to tell us what is the current state of plans for a manned mission to Mars? Do we have plans? Are we in early stages of doing missions that will eventually build to a manned mission to Mars?
NASA has a lot of long-range plans, and there's probably small pockets of very smart people coming up with scenarios that might work. But given the current flight equipment, metal already cut and so on, I don't think we have that capability. It will require new vehicles, new launch vehicles, and certainly new manned vehicles in order to do that, as Clay was mentioning earlier.
Mm-hmm. Clayton Anderson, where are we in that venture, that possible manned mission?
We're quite a ways away, I think. They tout that we'll send humans to Mars sometime in the 2030s time frame. I, for one, think that the logical step is to put a base on the moon first. And I say that because we know that there's water there now, and we tout that we can split the water into hydrogen and oxygen, and we can make rocket fuel and various things like that. And I believe that that's all true. But what I don't believe is that we know how we're going to do that. We don't know how we're going to get into the soil and dig it up and process it and then store it. You know, the Martian movie shows all that being done already, but I don't think we have that technology. So I'm an advocate to first go do it on the moon, which is only 3 days away, which has no communication delay, which provides us with the ability to send equipment there and test it out and then perhaps learn from it such that as we do parallel development to go to the red planet, then we have this lunar base where we're testing our things. Now, all of this requires money, as we've talked about, but I believe that it's not the destination that you choose. It's what you learn along the way and the technology development that happens as you push toward the moon or toward an asteroid or toward Mars. And that's what will ultimately benefit the humans back on Earth. So I think space is an investment for people. It's just hard when you throw out tens of hundreds of billions of dollars. People can't grab onto that. They think it's, you know, a lot of money being thrown at a target that doesn't help them.
Mm-hmm. And right, that would be one of the battles that would have to be fought. Would this mission ever get off the ground? Is it has to be justified when, as when we had the Apollo missions, there's so much need, suffering, and misery on the Earth. Why do this? And Clayton, your answer is?
My answer is as you go out in the backyard and you pop your portable battery into your portable drill and work on your fence, and then you finish that project and you head to Vail, Colorado to ski down the mountain and you squirt anti-fog into your goggles. And along the way to Vail, Colorado, you drive on a curved surface on Interstate 80 that allows you to have a safer transit in rainy and snowy weather. And as farmers in Iowa have an artificial sow that allows all of the piglets that come from the mother to survive rather than just a portion of her piglets, all of those things have their birth in NASA technology and in taxpayer investment dollars. So those are things that have come back from the investment in their space program. And that's why I believe in what we do, and I believe it's important. Not necessarily that we want to put a human footprint on the red surface of Mars.
Mm-hmm. Clay Anderson, you've talked about this in other editions of River to River, but perhaps a short capsule of how you're training people to be astronauts or giving them some astronaut training there at ISU today?
I'm not teaching them to be astronauts. What I'm trying to do is teach them to think operationally. And it can apply to a farmer that hops into his brand new combine cockpit, or an astronaut that hops into a spacecraft, or a consumer who gets into their brand new 2015 automobile. When they sit in those cockpits, it becomes relatively obvious to them quickly how much operational thought went into the development of that cockpit. Are the switches where they need to be? Is it clearly understood intuitively what throwing some of those switches or pushing some of those buttons are going to do? And most kids, for example, at Iowa State are taught very, very well in the physics of the problem, the F equals MA. I'm trying to get them to think more operationally as if they were the operator in the cockpit of these various vehicles or in the plant, observing the safety monitoring equipment that tells them that everything is functioning appropriately, which is very nicely depicted in The Martian, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
but it's a thought process. And the way I'm going about this thought process is to borrow training activities from those of us that train to become astronauts to help them enhance their operational thinking capability, thereby making them, when they graduate from Iowa State, more marketable to the companies like Caterpillar, John Deere, Boeing, SpaceX, and they're more prepared to go to work and think operationally right away.
Clayton Anderson with us, retired NASA astronaut, now on the faculty of Iowa State University, spent 5 months aboard the International Space Station before retiring. Steve Kowaler, professor of physics and astronomy at Iowa State University at our table, as well as Jasper Halicus, associate professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Iowa. Three perspectives on fiction and nonfiction of going to Mars this hour on River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's talk about colonization, possible colonization of Mars. I see here in the news that we have, this is an MIT study, I guess, humans could only survive on Mars for 68 days, according to this new study.
Exactly, 68 days.
I think I could push it to 69 or maybe 70.
Skip a couple meals, we'd be fine. We could stretch it to 75.
Breathe shallow.
Scientists at MIT concluded that with the current technology, a permanent settlement on Mars is, quote, not feasible. They analyzed a Dutch-based, it's called Mars One Project, which is aimed at colonizing the planet starting in 2024. This Mars One Project, it's a private group, wants to send a group of people on a one-way trip and film the project for a reality television show.
Good luck with that.
The key point there is one way.
Yeah, and I'm a card-carrying member of the Astronaut Corps, and all my trips better have a second bring me back on them.
Okay, so 68 days, what are the hurdles that you would face, Steve Kowaler? Dedicated a lot of time to looking at the possibility, the hunt for Earth-like planets around other stars. What would it take for us to colonize Mars? Are there the materials there or possibly things we could make out of the materials there that would help us survive?
If you had, again, infinite resources, lots and lots of money and smart people, you can do almost anything. Whether it would be worth doing is the real question there. Mars is interesting scientifically, but whether or not we need a permanent colony on Mars to reap the science benefits and whether that's a reasonable cost-benefit analysis is really up in the air as far as I'm concerned.
How so interesting scientifically? What makes it so?
Well, the possibility that life existed once on Mars or exists now. It's one of two of the best places in our solar system beyond the Earth to look for life. And so spending some time there with a human being that can actually move autonomously and search for either the chemical signatures of life or artifacts or what have you would be an important thing to do, because that would address directly the question whether the origin of life on Earth is a unique event in our solar system or even in our galaxy.
How confident are you that eventually, at some point, maybe not in our lifetimes, but at some point, life will be discovered on Mars or another celestial body?
I'm pretty confident. Before Kepler and before investigations to find planets around other stars, people who work in the area were convinced that planets were around pretty much every star in the galaxy, even though we knew of only one star that had planets. Now, 25 years later, we know of planets around thousands of other stars, and planets seem to be ubiquitous. They were right. The chemical basis for life is pretty complicated but understood at this point. Consciousness is another matter entirely, but self-replicating molecules, we know how they work. We just don't know how they got started. But the expectation is that given enough time and roughly the right conditions, life would get going. And so based on our past record of success, I would guess that those that say that life is ubiquitous in the galaxy are correct. When we find it, I think will be sooner rather than later. I'm optimistic that the proper experiments done below the surface of Mars will turn up something that would be interesting. I'm even more excited about the prospects elsewhere in the solar system, in particular the deep ocean that we know exists below the crust of Europa, one of the moons of Jupiter. We know that there's a deep saltwater ocean there that's been liquid perhaps for billions of years that has again, perhaps, all of the ingredients necessary to, for life to develop.
So Mars, as the fourth planet from the sun, is not what would you put in the Goldilocks region. I think that's how you classify them, isn't it, Steve? They've got to be the right distance from that particular star, our sun in this case.
That would be for liquid water to be more or less permanent on the surface. That's the canonical Goldilocks zone. That's for life as we know it, as it developed on Earth. Life is very tenacious, and so the zones around a star where life could develop just need a heat source. And if that heat source is the star, then you get this habitable zone, this Goldilocks zone. But if the heat source is tidal interactions, then Europa is in a habitable zone, even though it's well beyond the sun. Mm-hmm. And who knows what these other extrasolar planetary systems have under their cloak of invisibility right now.
I wonder if we would have to be careful about contaminating their life or vice versa, bringing back something that would contaminate us, a probe that would bring microbes from our planet to Mars, and in the way that when this planet was colonized, North America was vastly changed because of the microbes brought here.
Actually, we did, in fact, spend quite a bit of effort on what we call planetary protection, even for an orbiter that we built and sent to Mars. And the reason for that, as you said, is that eventually it will decay and it won't completely fragment on its path down to the surface. Big chunks of it will survive. So we had to go through extensive cleaning and heating of all of the surfaces on the spacecraft that we built. And we also had to go through an extensive analysis to make sure that the chunks of it that would fall down to the surface wouldn't be big enough that they wouldn't be fairly well sterilized. As you said, for a rover that has to land on the surface or for something, for instance, that would land on Europa, the planetary protection requirements that would be imposed by international agencies would be much more stringent. But whether that's good enough, it's really hard to say, right? Because as everyone is pointing out, life is tenacious, life is versatile. It's actually very, very difficult to get rid of every single, you know, little spore on a spacecraft.
On Mars, for instance, what are the parameters of temperature that any instrument we send there has to stand up to?
Oh, you've caught me on a detail that I probably can't answer, but I think we heat everything up to something like 90 C, which is not quite boiling, but it's a hot temperature, and we do our level best to get rid of everything. But there's a vigorous discussion right now about if, for instance, one of our rovers that we had on the surface could make it to one of these regions where we're seeing this briny liquid water, is that something we want to do?
Mm-hmm.
There are
mm-hmm.
risks.
Mm-hmm. Let's conclude by talking a little bit about the age-old debate about manned versus robot missions. Up to this point, there have been more than a half dozen missions to Mars successfully. What are the arguments for and against manned missions? Steve Kowaler?
Remember that NASA's acronym, NASA, some of us say not a science agency. NASA's purpose is not to boldly go where no man has gone before and make breakthrough science discoveries. It's basically a technology testing firm in the best of all senses. And so those of us that are interested in the science output of NASA take a back seat to those other functions. So as excited as I am about all of NASA's unmanned science experiments, like the Hubble Space Telescope, which everyone loves, like the Kepler spacecraft, which I work with, like all of the unmanned planetary probes. Everybody loves those results, but those results are technology test beds more than anything else.
Clay Anderson, do we belong in space? Shouldn't we do this at much less cost with a greater yield of scientific results, findings at a lower cost?
As an astronaut who did 6 spacewalks, if there is a robotic capability that can go out and do some of the jobs that I did, such that I don't have to risk my life to do that job, it's probably going to be a little bit cheaper in the long run. But today we have robots on the space station that are supposed to do exactly that. One of them is inside and has yet to go outside and struggles to pull a Kleenex out of a box. Another robot outside that's also designed to do that. At this point in our technology development, it takes almost 4 times the amount of hours, user hours, and it has to be driven by people on the ground to do the same thing a suited astronaut could do in one spacewalk. So we're learning all the time, and the two, unmanned and manned, have to go in tandem to me. To send things to Mars, look at all the things that we're learning, such that if we do send humans to Mars eventually, we're going to be way smarter as to where we should put that base of humans to keep them safe, to get the maximum science return, to have a human being be able to look and interpret and perhaps change the experiment in real time to enhance the amount of data that we receive.
Let's end by connecting the fiction with the nonfiction. If you had any thoughts on this, what is the role of a movie like The Martian? This is Ridley Scott's first positive science fiction movie. We had Blade Runner. We had Alien. Very dark movies. But this is a positive movie there. Do any of you think that these go hand in hand, visions as portrayed by Hollywood or another movie maker, to give us a vision to strive for, Jasper?
Well, absolutely. I mean, my favorite line in the movie, and I'll paraphrase because there was an obscenity, was I'm going to have to science the heck out of this. And that's fantastic, right? I mean, that's science and engineering portrayed in the most favorable possible light. And in our divided and conflicted society today, I think that's absolutely what we need. Science could be the answer. Science could be the way out, right? But science is unfortunately being politicized now. So the more that science can be seen in a positive light as a tool that we can use to find solutions, I think it's absolutely critical in this day and age to communicate that to the public.
Mm-hmm. Closing thoughts from Clay and Steve in Ames.
NASA is doing a much better job of piggybacking on this movie as a way to inspire and create interest in NASA itself, but also science in general and the ability of humans to think and get their way out of problems by coming up with ingenious solutions. And anytime we challenge the human intellect to solve a difficult problem, I think we are coming out ahead in most, if not all, instances. And as a father and as an instructor at Iowa State and as a person who believes in what NASA does, anything we can do to inspire young American students to follow science, technology, engineering, arts, and math, those are very important things, and I'm all for that.
I'm going to join the chorus in saying that anything that brings the public, the attention of the public to the science that we're able to do now and that we may be able to do in the not-too-distant future is a good thing. It's also a great story. It's a very inspiring story. And also by including the realistic aspects of NASA operations, hopefully people will remember what NASA's been able to do in the past in terms of putting men on the moon and bringing them back safely when things go wrong. That you can't make that stuff up. The NASA's history is in the books. It really did happen. You can go to the National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C., and touch a piece of the moon. There's a moon rock available for you to put your finger on. That's an extraordinarily inspiring thing to do. And by having realistic movies that portray the science properly, that portray the personalities in a somewhat accurate way, really gives us the hope that we can continue to do that in the future.
And if I can throw one last thing in here, you know,
Clay, sure.
I did write a book called The Ordinary Spaceman, and while I am doing a shameless plug, I want to point out that the title of The Ordinary Spaceman is very important to me and to young people, at least in the Midwest. I was just an ordinary kid who, with the help of people who, of my family, my friends, my educators, my coaches, all those folks, helped to mold me into someone who was able to do some extraordinary things. And that is what I believe is the human condition, right? Most people are simply humans, but with the extra effort, the activity that goes into it, and with us collaborating together rather than against one another, we can do some extraordinary things. And that is a premise that I would love to have every human being on Earth grab a hold of.
Okay. It's been a wonderful hour to get your thoughts as we stretch out into space. Clayton Anderson, retired NASA astronaut, now at Iowa State University. Steve Kowaler at Iowa State University is a professor of physics and astronomy. And Jasper Halleck is associate professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Iowa in Iowa City. What a wonderful hour, and given us a lot of things to think about for the present and the future. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you.
River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.